Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, Brand Dugas of the Tennessee Williams and New Orleans Literary Festival previews that upcoming festival as well as the Saints and Sinners LGBTQ Literary Festival. We'll also hear from Desiree Richter, author of The Presence of Absence. Festival season kicks into high gear this month for literary folks. Rand Dugas is here to tell us what's going on with the Tennessee Williams and New Orleans Literary Festival, now in its 39th year, and the Saints and Sinners Literary Festival, which turns 22 this year. Rand is an assistant professor at Southeastern Louisiana University and the assistant editor of Louisiana Literature and editor of the magazines Louisiana Life and Acadiana Profile. But today, she's wearing her Tennessee Williams hat. Rand, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much, Susan. I'm so glad to be here.
So here we go, starting March 23rd with the Stanley and Stella Shouting Contest. That's the beginning of the festival now instead of the end, and it's always a good time.
It really is. It's so much fun, and it's a great kickoff for the festival.
And it's just legendary now. People expect to see such crazy stuff at that sell-off.
And there are crazy things that happen. People rip their shirts off. There's men, women, and children come out and scream. It's really a lot of fun.
Reenactors of Tennessee Williams,
yes,
of course. Now, this is the 39th year.
Correct.
How many years have you been going to the festival, and how long have you been working on it? What is it you like about it?
I don't remember if it's 15 or 20 years that I've been going, but I teach at Southeastern, and we've helped out with the festival in the past.
You have that great partnership.
Yeah, so I've been introducing authors and volunteering for probably about 15 years, and then I've come on board in the past couple years to help with publicity. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I love this festival. I'm the biggest cheerleader for it, even before I started working with the festival. It's just such a lovely event. It's warm. The people are excited to be there. There's great energy, and there's such a range of programs. People can find almost anything they're interested in there. And it's a great sense of literary community and a celebration of New Orleans writers, too.
And a great literary landmark, too, which makes it so much fun at the Hotel Mont Leon. We'll talk about some of the special guests that'll be on hand this year. One of the ones I know a lot of people are looking forward to is Ming Stoll, who appears for opening night.
That's going to be so much fun. Yeah, she was in a lot of John Waters films and is just going to put on a really great show for opening night. And we're also going to have Harry Mirone and Dr. Sick. So it'll be a lot. It'll be a very fun event.
And who are some of the other standouts for you?
At the festival?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're having Pulitzer Prize winner Michael Cunningham. And we're also going to have Gillian Flynn, Megan Abbott, Bernice McFadden, Maureen Corrigan, Laura Lippman. There's lots of really amazing people that are going to be there this year.
Now, there are lots of different kinds of walking tours.
Yeah, there are. There are LGBT walking tours. There's one on queer underground. There's a literary tour. There's a ghost tour.
Yeah.
So there's all kinds. We have like four or five, I think, going on.
And then there are so many craft sessions. One of my favorite ones is called Make It Weird.
I know E.M. Tran is doing that one, and she's such a good speaker and instructor. I think that'll be really interesting. There's also one on fairy tales and how to incorporate tarot cards in your writing. And then there's one on stage writing. So there's lots of really interesting ones. And there's going to be one by Chin Sun Lee on prose from imagery, how to use an image to inform your writing.
So there are lots of very specific workshops and general topics
yes.
as well. So that's great. Now, Thursday night is really a special night with a tribute reading. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It is a special night. It's at the New Orleans Jazz Museum, and we're going to have people come there, and they're going to be reading one-act plays, which are really important in Tennessee's creative life. There's going to be Maureen Corrigan, Michael Cunningham, Jewel Gomez, Tim Murray, Mink Stole, and people just get up and read portions, and it's really just a happy event that people are always excited to go to.
And a reminder of all the wonderful things Tennessee Williams said and wrote, so that's always fun. And theater offerings are all over the place next weekend.
Yes, we're going to have Orpheus Descending, and there's a really great play called Harold and St. Claude. We're going to have an event by the Mudlark Puppeteers.
I love them.
Yeah, they're so fun.
So that's a little something different.
Mm-hmm.
And then Saturday brings something that's very dear to my heart, the Pinkley Prize celebration, which has a whole afternoon of programs devoted to crime writing and mystery fiction with people like Megan Abbott, Laura Lippman, Gillian Flynn, and then the winners of the Pinkley Prize over the past 10 years. The Pinkley Prize was named for Diana Pinkley, who was a columnist for the Times-Picayune and reviewed crime fiction for years and years and years.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought this would be a wonderful way to honor her memory. And we've had a great time bringing these writers to town. So if you love crime fiction, that's the place to be on Saturday.
That is all day Saturday. Crime fiction and mystery writing. There are events all day, and it's ending with a 1920s themed murder mystery party that night, which should be really fun.
So there's a little bit of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Now talk about Saints and Sinners.
Saints and Sinners is in its 22nd year, and it began as a way to spread information about AIDS, HIV, and it's grown into the longest-running LGBTQ plus literary festival in existence. And it's just a weekend of similar events as the Tennessee Williams Festival. There are literary panels, there are writers' craft sessions, there's readings.
So you're a writer yourself. I'd like you to give us a sense of what writers get out of this long weekend, what it does for you.
It's a really great mix of things that writers can get from the festival. A lot of it is instruction, just information about craft, which is so important, especially people who aren't in an MFA program or don't have access. They can go sit in with an author and take basically a class from them. And so that's really something that's important. The literary panels, they get to get like a freestyle discussion with some of their favorite authors. And that's also really helpful, I think, for writers. And just the things that happen in the hallways between sessions, meeting other writers, going to have lunch with somebody new that you haven't met before. I made a friend on the writing marathon last year that is now a writing partner of mine. So I think instruction and community are the things that writers can really get.
Well, talk about the writing marathon, because it's one of the unique things, too.
I love the writing marathon, and I've been doing that for so long. Dr. Richard Luth is the head of the New Orleans Writing Marathon, and it's just such a wonderful, restorative experience. A bunch of writers meet together, and Dr. Luth will give some thoughts or maybe a prompt or an inspiration for the day, and then everybody breaks up into little groups and just organically, whoever they feel like writing with goes to some place in the quarter, a coffee shop, a bar, a bench. They write. They share their writing. It's very, you only can say thank you after someone reads, so it's not like you're ever being judged or somebody's going to ask a question or anything like that. And at the end of the day, everybody makes their way back, and they usually do a reading. But it's just very inspirational, because usually people don't bring anything they're working on. It's just whatever comes into their mind for the day.
At that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it's inspired by the surroundings, of course.
Definitely. So, we have two writing marathons this festival.
Oh, that's fantastic. The thing I like about it is that you find out how approachable authors really are, that they love to hear what you think. They love to meet their readers. It's, the warmth of this event, I think.
Yeah, it is. I think sometimes people think that writers are way up on another plane and they're just people. And it is a nice chance sometimes, and people can get their book signed. Sometimes they can just have a conversation or ask a question of an author. And that's a rare opportunity that sometimes, unless they go to their independent bookstores for author readings, they just don't have the opportunity to exchange like that.
And everybody goes home with lots of books, too.
Yes.
Which is always...
Yes. We have a bookstore there with all the author's books, so people can get all the books they want.
Well, it's going to be another great outing. It's hard to believe it's been 39 years.
I know.
The first one I went to was the second one. That's how old I am. But, you know, I've seen it come and go, and it's just really exciting. It's survived Katrina, all kinds of things.
The pandemic.
Right.
They had to make a quick pivot for that year. Tracy Cunningham is amazing, and Paul Willis. They've done such a great job with the festival. They're always so thoughtful about planning and just looking at every single detail to make sure that people have a really good experience and that it's representative of New Orleans and Tennessee Williams. We have over 50 New Orleans writers this year in our program.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Just New Orleans writers.
Yes.
Oh, girl.
We want to celebrate them. That's what makes New Orleans this literary center.
And any one of them could be the next Tennessee Williams. You never know.
That's true.
That's great. Well, we've been talking with Rand Dukas of the Tennessee Williams and New Orleans Literary Festival, which comes up Sunday, March 23rd, with the Stanley and Stella Shouting Contest. Thanks so much, Rand.
Thank you for having me, Susan.
I am so glad to meet Desiree Richter, a New Orleans writer, musician, and educator. She writes about bereavement, post-fundamentalism, and parenting, especially in her first book, The Presence of Absence. Kitchen Table talks about parenting, leaving fundamentalism, and the very messy business of living with loss. It's published by the University of New Orleans Press. Desiree, welcome.
Thank you. It's so lovely to be here.
This is such a moving book, and it was inspired by your journey through grief after the terrible loss of your young son, Elijah, who was only 2 years old in a terrible accident, one of those things no one ever sees coming.
Yes.
So you had four other children. You had to keep going.
Yes.
And you finally came to write this book. So talk about making that decision, that commitment to writing.
You know, the decision made itself, because as we know, writing can be part of our healing journeys. Mm-hmm. And I started writing about Elijah very privately, probably around 2009, 2010. And every day I would walk to a coffee shop and flip it up on my laptop and just process what was going on. And sometimes it would be a little short snippet, and sometimes it would be what eventually became cornerstone essays in this book. And one day, I decided to put them all together because I'm also a researcher, and I thought, what themes might I see in this work? What might I learn if I take a look at past Desiree and see what she was going through in light of present Desiree? So I put them all together in a Word document, and that is when I really started thinking that there might be something worth offering. I think when you start writing about something that's sensitive and so personal,
yeah,
you need to handle it with care. And I didn't want to send something out into the world that was just going to be triggering musings of somebody who's really sad. I wanted to offer something. So did you
read a lot of grief memoirs? Did you read a lot of books about grief as you were experiencing this?
I read a few. I remember reading one in particular. I don't remember the name of it, but it was a woman whose husband had passed away one day. He had went outside for a jog, had a heart attack, and passed away in the road. And I just remember her talking about how much grief changes you. And it was the first writing I had seen that gave me permission to let myself become an entirely different version of myself, which I think we now know love will do in all of its many forms, whether you are just falling in love, whether you have had a lifelong relationship with someone. All those little things that we do are tying the cords of love with our beloved. So it only makes sense that when that, as I say in the book, the great seam ripper of loss comes along.
As it will to all of us.
As it will, and as it does daily. Mm-hmm. And so I think that permission to evolve beyond the version of myself that gave birth to Elijah and still have the integrity of my love for him was really helpful in that one memoir in particular.
I can just imagine him so clearly from reading these pages. I mean, the way you describe that one little linguistic thing he does when at the end of, you know, door shut, oh, please. It's the oh, please that gets you, you know, and you have that gift of capturing the small, memorable thing that stays with you every minute of every day.
I think we all do that in our own way. Mm-hmm. And I think we get reminded of it. You know, one of the things that didn't make it into the book was, you know, just going to the grocery store and seeing these grief triggers, and or you hear a song of somebody that you had a moment with, and you're immediately transported back to that time with them. So I hope that in honoring Elijah and showing people a little bit of who this little person was, it can also help them be grateful and be able to take the time to sit with their people again. Mm-hmm. Because we, you know, we do these memorials and we all sit around, and we did it for Elijah, sitting around his grave or in the church, and we were talking and we were laughing. And I think that one of the most painful things is that we have these momentous occasions, and it's like it's societally some sort of open and shut experience. And it's like, well, now we're done with that.
We've got closure.
Yeah. And now we move on to the next thing. And I think we do this societally as well. You know, big things happen and nobody really just sits with it for very long. And yet, you know, you're walking through days and you're having these things jog your memory, and sometimes they're painful, and sometimes they make you laugh, sometimes they make you cry, sometimes they put you on the floor. And that's really a lot of what I wanted to do with this book, is to not just write a book of essays treating grief as some sort of a concept, though I do a little bit of that, but to try to give a window into what is it like when you're walking day by day by day, now over 20 years since this little person has left my life, and we're all doing it.
Yeah.
We're all doing it every single day.
Now, this journey for you was complicated by your loss of faith along the way. That's a big prop to lose in the middle of an experience like this. So talk about writing about that. And it's even more complicated for you because you were a preacher's kid.
Yeah, still am. You know, and it's interesting because even since I've written the book, I've revisited this idea of what does it mean to lose faith? And I wouldn't even say that I've completely lost faith writ large. I lost faith in a very particular way of making sense of the world. Mm-hmm. I lost faith in open and shut answers of a particular brand of fundamentalism that did not match the actual living, breathing experience of what love feels like. So it was complicated because I was trying to square something, and we're always trying to make sense of the hard things in life.
Oh, yeah.
And since this was an accident that happened in our home, and, you know, this is a child under my care, it felt really hard to square it with a version of a fundamentalist faith and a certain type of God. You know, the stories around that were, you know, that God's going to use this for good, or that this is some sort of discipline. Just all the stories that we tell ourselves, or, you know, one of the hardest ones is that, you know, he was just some casualty in some great war for good and evil. And I think one of the best things about letting go of trying to make sense through this lens was I talk about it, as much as this is a huge chasm in my heart, it kind of right-sized the whole experience. And I was able to finally come to terms, like you said, these are accidents. There are things that are unknowable in this life. So I wouldn't say I've completely lost faith or faith in the goodness of humans, but I had to let go of a very particular type of faith that I think was harmful to me. And as I get to in the book, that I was passing down to my kids in a way that was harming them. So there's all that reckoning to do as well.
So talk about, you have this incredible description of what it's like to reach grief zero. That's what you call it. Mm-hmm. And you know, everybody's going to get there eventually. So I wonder if you could describe that a little bit for us.
Grief zero is the epicenter of loss. It is the moment when you step over a threshold and your life was one thing and now it's another. Mm-hmm. And the atmosphere around you changes and you are in grief in that moment. It happened for me when we woke up and found that our son was no longer with us. It happens when you get a diagnosis. It happens when you see something on an email that maybe you didn't want to see and find out that the love that you thought you had is not the love that you thought you had. Mm-hmm. It can happen in so many ways. And it's like also similar to absolute zero, where things in your heart, they almost stop. You feel cold. You feel numb. You're in shock. All of these things are happening to you bodily. And the world around you is still spinning. And you can't really make sense of it. You can't theorize with it. You can't meaning make with it. You're just absolutely brought to your knees. Mm-hmm. You lose your senses. Lydia Yugnovich has a wonderful description of this when she talks about giving birth to her stillborn daughter. And she says she lost her marbles.
So what did this do for you? How did you know you were finished with it? How did you know you'd written it out in a way?
That is such a great question. I think that the revision process, because it happened with a wonderful editor.
Yeah.
And because I'm a writing coach, I know that there is a little bit of it's never done, it's just due that comes into play. So I don't think I had some great cosmic moment that I was like, oh, I'm done now. Yeah. It really was just working through the process. But I will say this. I think that there's a chapter in the book that is really just about other art that I've written in response to this loss, the music. And I think that capping off the book near the end with these musings. And when the book sort of moved from just my experience to getting a little bit meta about itself and what is the role of writing. And you know, that's the thing you said about the book. It's not all one thing. So there's essay, there's
wonderful
research.
Wonderful list.
There's blogs.
Yeah.
We've got it all in there. There's song lyrics, there's stories. And I think that when I got to the point where I was able to contemplate in a latter essay, what is healing? And really sit with that. And also the sense that I had done right by Elijah and that there was a part of me as a memory bearer that has introduced him to the world.
Yes.
So I think feeling the release of, I'm not the only one carrying this anymore.
And I'm not the only one who remember him.
Yeah.
Well, it's a very friendly book. I love the way you welcome people to the book at the very beginning. So readers will miss you when it's over.
Well, I am here online on a Facebook page and a website upcoming and open to continuing the conversation.
Good.
In any way.
Good.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking with Desiree Richter, whose new book is The Presence of Absence. Kitchen Table Talks about parenting, leaving fundamentalism, and the very messy business of living with loss. You can meet her at this year's Tennessee Williams and New Orleans Literary Festival. Desiree, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Tel Aviv essayist Jennifer Lang will discuss the writing life, where to start, what to write about, where to find inspiration. Saturday, March 15th at 9:30 a.m. at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. One Book, One New Orleans presents a workshop about uncovering your family history with author Fatima Sheikh. That's Saturday, March 15th from 10:30 to noon at the Rosa Keller Library and Community Center. It's free, but register at Eventbrite. Philip Hoos signs his children's book, Claudette Colvin, I Want Freedom Now, Saturday, March 15th at 10 a.m. at Octavia Books. Larry Bagneris signs Call Me Larry, A Creole Man's Triumph Over Racism and Homophobia, Saturday, March 15th from 2 to 3 p.m. at the historic New Orleans Collection gift shop. Poets Brad Richard, Sky Jackson, and Julie Kane read from their new book Sunday, March 16th at 6 at the Domino on St. Claude. Scholar Sadia Hartman, author of Wayward Lives, Beautiful Experiments, presents a lecture, Critical Fabulation and the Tense of History, Tuesday, March 18th at 6 at Xavier University's Cutter Auditorium. Genealogist Gaynell Brady will lead a presentation focusing on African-American heritage, Tuesday, March 18th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. New Orleans writers Marguerite Sheffer, author of The Man in the Banana Trees, Anel Lopez, author of I'll Give You a Reason, and Vanessa Saunders, author of The Flat Woman, read Wednesday, March 19th at 5:30 at the Norman Mayer Library. Sloane Crosley appears in conversation with Nathaniel Rich and signs her memoir, Grief is for People, Wednesday, March 19th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. This is a ticketed event. Kayla Min Andrews appears in conversation with Maurice Carlos Ruffin to celebrate the paperback publication of The Fetishist by her late mother, Catherine Min. This is the fourth annual Catherine Min celebration, Thursday, March 20th at 6 at Octavia Books. Mary H.K. Choi, the 2025 recipient of McDowell's Catherine Min Fellowship, will also appear. Free for All, Inside the Public Library, a new documentary that focuses on the value of public libraries in daily American life, will be screened Thursday, March 20th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The documentary was produced by Don Logston and Lucy Faulkner. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.